on to get involved. The question is whether we should continue to stay after we've got a distasteful taste in our mouth and decide that it's time to get out of the process. And that's a legitimate question to ask. In our assessment of the situation, the answer was no. There was very little to accomplish by continued participation. But channels of communication do remain open, as I mentioned.
Senator Joe.
Okay. Along those lines, you have mentioned the problem. You have two problems with the land exchange. Format, timetable.
No, three.
Well, 90-10.
All right. But if the format, you have to have one of those two options that you listed in your paper last Saturday. Do you have to have one of those options for a format, or is that negotiable on the state side?
The context that I presented those alternatives, and I think I prefaced it in the paper, these are two of, not necessarily all-inclusive. There are two possibilities.
All right. Now, is the Fish and Wildlife Service willing to look at any other alternatives other than the ones other than the system you're setting up right now in this track selection and type process?
Senator Jones, I'm not sure how to respond to that. I guess we're still negotiating. I guess the way I would respond, as long as there's open negotiations, anything is possible with the people that you're negotiating with. It's a question, I guess, of if there's a better idea and somebody's got a better idea, I don't see any reason, and it's in the public interest, why we wouldn't pursue a better idea.
Well, you see, the state says there is a better idea, so are you willing to look at those, or do you have to go to the native corporations? Of course, both of you, I guess, have to look at it.
I don't know. Senator Jones, I think you have to, again, put all of this in context, and I think my state friends here have attempted to do that, and that is that we are negotiating what we consider to be a model contract, and we've spent a fair amount of time and effort on that, and the state's been involved for several months. I think the state would have to make a demonstrable case that it's in everybody's best interest to alter that in a significant way, and if that case can be made, then it can be made, and I don't think our minds are close to that, but up to this point, I don't think we have heard a suggestion that we're willing to pursue at this point, but quite frankly, there hasn't been that sort of discussion in an open forum or in a negotiating forum with the state.
Gotta be at the table, Frank.
Well, then...
I mean, it just... Now, maybe there has been between Assistant Secretary Horn and John Katz, but certainly there hasn't with members of the negotiating team. In fact, you know, there have been discussions of some of these alternatives, and I don't want to suggest that those haven't been looked at in advance of even the state coming to the table. But what we're attempting to do is come up with an approach that's acceptable to all of the participants, and right now we seem to have found a mechanism by which to do that.
Right now, excuse me, but there's only two participants, the federal government and the Native Corporation, at the table.
Well, except that there are five entities and will be five separate contracts. The concept, the exchange concept, is being embraced. But I mean, I'm not sure, quite frankly, although I would ask the Native Corporations to speak for themselves, if it came down to an all or nothing kind of a scenario, but at some point they might not be willing to look at alternatives, but they're pursuing the alternative, and so are we, that we see in our best interest at this point. That's not to suggest that other alternatives might not work and might not be pursued at some point, but right now nothing has been suggested that anybody has picked up and run with, but it hasn't been suggested in a structured, formalized sort of a setting. It's simply in this sort of a setting, and I guess my reaction to that is maybe this isn't the best place to try to negotiate that sort of thing.
Before we go any further, let the record show that Representative Sun has joined us some time ago. Welcome to the table, and we offer you full rein of the committee, Representative. If you have any questions, why, see if you can wedge in between these senators here.
I appreciate the opportunity. I've sat through hours and hours and hours of hearings on the House Resource Committee on these same issues, so I sense the thread of the discussion here, so to speak.
Senator Jones, one other point I think might be helpful to the committee is that, and this goes into the rescission options issue and when you can back out and when you can say no, the way the present contract is written, The participants, at least the native corporations, and I presume the state would if they were there negotiating a contract, they have the option to say no even after legislation has been passed by Congress. Because if the opening legislation and the legislation that comes down in the form of approving these, if we get that far, is unacceptable to the native corporations, they can go home then. So the thing isn't totally in terms of out of the hands of the participants, particularly the native corporations, once it goes to Congress. Once it goes to Congress, if Congress, say, for example, decides on an exploration program only, then the native corporations have to make a decision. They have a decision to make. Are they going to pursue this based only on exploration only, or are they going to drop the whole thing and go home? So there are a series of triggers and opportunities for people to say no in the way this thing is set up and go home.
Mr. Chairman, another thing to add to Senator Jones' question, because I sense that he's getting at the perspective, can the process be altered in some manner at this point? One other constraint that I just want to lay out for the record is that the native corporations each have industry participants, partners, some of them several, and their arrangements individually, of which I have no knowledge, incidentally, I'm sure they all differ, but they're geared towards this current process. And I also sense, having had informal discussions with these folks, the Native Corporation people and their attorneys, that it would create some difficulty for them to alter the present format. And I just wish to bring that to the committee's attention.
But it's, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead.
But it's the position of the state, if the format stays the same and the timetable stays the same, the state will stay out.
If it stays the way it is right now, that is correct. But yet, even though I mentioned that, which I did because I wanted you to be fully aware of that, I think there still is some hope. At the end of every tunnel, hopefully there is light, and there is some possibility that restructuring could occur. This is going to be, I think, one thing that's evident from everybody who's participated in both the exchanges and the ANWR issue itself. This is a complex, lengthy process that's likely to take a long time. And I sense that there's going to be opportunities in the future for a whole lot of things.
Follow that through, Senator. One point. Has the state requested of the Fish and Wildlife that format be restructured? Has there been a formal request go forward to try and get the format restructured or the timetable changed or to in that process, Gary? Has there anything gone forward formally, i.e. letter like the exchange between Cotton and I see Tom Lester had a letter, and then, has there been any formal requests? Let me put it that way.
Mr. Chairman, there have been two things that I am aware of. Early in January, John Katz's office sent several letters to the Department of Interior articulating concerns that the state had with the overall exchange contract and process and making certain suggestions for change. Secondly, and as was discussed this morning, John Katz has had personal discussions with Bill Horn on the subject of an overriding royalty and whether that could be put together.
That was in January. And
that was in first, like I said, the meeting that I attended in which it was discussed was the first week of February. Yeah. There may have been additional meetings, and I sense there have been discussions since that time.
You're saying there have been?
I sense
since
that there have been. John Katz, again, as of 2 days ago, reported that he was going to be putting together a response to Bill Horn's letter to Sam Cotton, in which he was going to deal with the issue of overriding royalty, because he didn't feel that the Assistant Secretary had precisely articulated the nature of the state-federal interface on that issue.
Can we, for the record, get those two exchanges that Katz had? Your letters?
Yes.
January 1. I don't believe we have those, do we, Bruce? The January 1 and the February 1.
They're both in, they are letters, and they our public information. They were the first 2 weeks of January.
Any problem with that? Tom, you watch the clock. If you got to catch a 2:45.
Well, I don't have to. I mean, I'm at the committee's disposal, and
well, we get rolling on these things. What we can do is, if you wanted to catch that early plane, and I want to try and accommodate you, unless the committee's got some things, we can have our aide just keep the questions, and we'll be sending you probably a 6-page letter on questions.
Might be a more expeditious way to respond, because that way the questions would be clearly articulated, and hopefully I could more clearly articulate an answer as opposed to
why don't we do that, and why don't we let you go so that you can be with your family, and but we're going to keep Gary here.
I appreciate the accommodation, and my apologies.
Yeah, Senator Jones will run you down to the ferry, and we'll go ahead and continue, because then as soon as we get done, why, maybe John will have you so that we can bring on the BLM. Yes, John.
Senator Coghill, just for the record, I want it to be abundantly clear to everybody here today that the negotiation that is being conducted with the Native corporations is being conducted only with the Native corporations. And whatever, or if they have any industry partners, in the terms and conditions of any agreements they might have with their industry partners, have no bearing whatsoever on our negotiations and are not a consideration at the negotiating table. And I think that's important to make that point for the record, because we simply aren't doing business with their industry partners. We're negotiating with private corporations, Native corporations.
Well, we understand that the whole land selection process that you outlined to us, and the analysis and how we will go through that whole procedure was quite intricate, you know, and nobody really has a finger on any particular piece and says, that's my piece.
Well, Senator, I was concerned about the inference that perhaps we were inhibited in some way by changing the format or the timing associated with the negotiation because of some sort of a relationship between the Native corporations and industry, and that's simply not the case. It has no bearing on our negotiations.
I don't think that was ever implied. It was implied that there was, well, I don't know.
But the point is, we understand the clarification.
Yeah. Okay. See, where do we start from here?
BLM.
No, I think that have you pretty well exhausted what John Noble has got in the whole process of fish and wildlife, or you're going to be with us for the next day in a way, so.
Through today.
Through today. You're going to go back on that late plane tonight?
No, sir. I've got to go back to Washington to negotiate starting tomorrow. I'll be leaving tomorrow to go back to Washington.
Oh, you go the other way?
Yes, Washington, D.C.
All right. You're negotiating back there with the five, there's five at the table right now.
Yes, sir. In fact, there are negotiations underway as we sit here with Old Harbor, and there is a series of independent negotiations with each of the participants next week, and another group meeting a week from today. The subject of those negotiations are the revised contract.
Okay. I guess it still bothers me a little bit why those are being done in private. Because we've got a public purpose or a public, there, it's a public's business, that why it's being negotiated behind closed doors. And I think that's the thing that disturbs a lot of people within the state of Alaska, is that things are going on back in Washington, maybe not where that they're not aware of what's going on, and that it has an awful lot to do with their future and their destiny. And I don't know whether that's an issue that you can even address, or if that's a policy issue that goes above it.
Well, Senator, I might comment on that. I think just as a matter of practical negotiations, it's very difficult. We're often sitting in a room now with over 20 people attempting to negotiate contracts, and right now, during the next week, we'll be dealing with 180 pages of contracts. And I guess just as a apart from any of our interests or what we would in some cases like to be able to do in the way we'd like to be able to do it, as a practical matter, it's very difficult to be able to negotiate in an open forum, quite frankly. And at the time that we have all these pieces put together, we will be coming to the public forum. And I think another important point to remember is the agreements won't be signed. These actual contracts won't be signed until we have gone forward to the public and explained what's in them. The only agreements that are going to be assigned before that time would be the preliminary agreements necessary to get to tract identification. And once the tracts are identified and the values are on the table on those tracts, then we will move into the public arena and explain the terms and conditions that have been negotiated and what sort of values are represented and what sort of public interest is represented by what we're proposing to do. So I understand your concern, but at the same time, there is going to be that opportunity, and then after should the Secretary move forward with the recommendation, then there would again be another opportunity for public scrutiny in the legislative process, of course. So I think we see two opportunities for public input into the process.
Yeah, I guess probably, John, is that where the people, where a lot of confusion is in the whole exchange process, is that you have to go back to the provisions of ANSCA to pick up the authorities that you have and some of the things that are going on. This paper, position paper on Kaksovik, Alaska, or Arctic Slope Regional Corporation conveyances probably tells us more of the background history in being able to go to the table. I notice that under Section 1431-0, they have 40 years option to exchange, and I don't think that this is a very common piece of knowledge in the state.
Well, I can't speak to that particular issue, Senator.
But you wanted to ask a question.
One other point I think it might be important to recognize is that we have met, you know, with numerous individuals and with groups and discussed the exchange, and I'm available when I'm in the office. If somebody wants to come in and talk about it, I've met with Representative Cotton's staff, I've met with members of the environmental community, I've met with Mr. Adler for trustees and attempted to explain how the thing is proceeding. So I guess I'm a little bit upset when I hear the word secret. Even though the negotiations are between the principals and they are behind closed doors, at least to the degree that we've reached some agreement, we've been pretty willing, I think, to lay that out for folks, and I think we've done, to the degree that we can, we've laid that out for you folks, so really, the discussions are closed, but they're really not secret, I don't think.
Okay. I'll take that for an explanation for right now. Is anybody, Senator Jones?
Beyond all the exchanges and that, isn't the political reality of this thing that if we're ever going to open up that area for exploration and development, it has to be under an administration that's willing to work toward that goal? I mean, you know, even though we have a Congress right now that may waffle one way or the other, don't we have to try to bring this all together under an administration that really wants it to happen?
They can't answer that.
You can't answer that, can you?
Tilt.
But I think,
you know,
and still the states, through all this discussion and everything, I still see the state standing tough on, you'd rather go alone and battling this thing than having help from the native corporations.
Senator Jones, I don't feel that's a fair characterization whatsoever. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sturgeon.
No, excuse me.
Let me clarify that. What you're saying is that if land exchanges go forth, you feel that it diminishes the chances of getting approval from Congress on opening up the Anwar.
It may do so, yes.
Is it because of private inholdings being there, or what? Maybe I missed something on why you felt that was. Or was that something Mr. Custer was?
Well, I think actually both of us have at one time or another today and in previous meetings. And I'll recap that again for you. The reasons were that it's a disruptive and distractive influence which takes away the focus of opening the coastal plain, what we think should be the number one priority of Alaskans, to get the coastal plain open to responsible development. And then secondly, the current format of the trades is unacceptable to the state's interests by virtue of the 90-10, by virtue of the information base, and so on.
Well, we beat this band around the barn about five times. I think that it's clear, though. I think it's very helpful to the committee that we do this, and I think that if there's no further questions of John Doble, that maybe we could have BLM come to the table and we'll talk about land exchange parks, and if you feel comfortable to stay right where you're at, why, we'll just go at it on another structure, another subject. How about a 2-minute break? That sounds good. And we have Reed Smith and Mike Menge with us from BLM, and we still have our gentleman from the state. We're going to go ahead and go forward with Reed. Would you have a presentation?
Yes, my name is Reed Smith, the Deputy State Director for Minerals with the Bureau of Land Management. I have with me Mike Menge, who is in charge of the group that actually does the mineral evaluation for the Bureau. We have a short presentation, just a very general presentation, and then we thought we could answer any detailed questions that you might have after that presentation.
Okay.
Senator, I'd like to, it may be a little inconvenient, I'd like to work with the overheads just a little bit. Whereas one picture is worth 1,000 words, as many words as you've heard this morning, maybe we can speed the process along a little bit here.
Yeah, why don't you take one of those? If you're going to work with, are you going to go up there?
I think
you could probably take the, I don't know, we got a mic right there behind to just take it off of the, and you can hang on to it maybe. Yeah.
Great.
Just kidding.
Thank you. You reading me over there? Coming through?
That's a recording mic. It's not a
yeah. Okay. Are you getting it on the tape, though?
Yes, that's what we can hear. We can hear you.
In other words, are your eardrums blasting?
Lights.
Nice profile, Bruce.
Here we go.
There we
go. I'd like to just talk about the overall process and how we're tossing in those pertinent pieces of information that relate to the 1002 assessment process. But I think it'd make it a little bit easier if you'd grasp the overall process through utilization of some of these overheads, particularly this one here. As you know, the BLM and the U.S. Geological Survey worked in concert to put together the 1002 mineral assessment. The upper line, geologic considerations, was basically a joint effort, at least the first two ovals that you see there, source rock and reservoir rock. For an oil accumulation to be accurately described, all three of those particular entities have to be present in one form or another. That was the thrust of our investigations and interpretations. It also, toward reaching conclusions in those three ovoids, we used all of the information at our disposal. the source rock the first consideration. In the 1002 area, source rock is composed primarily of shales. Shale contains the raw material necessary to generate the oil and gas that we're looking for. Some of the things that we're considering are whether that shale was from terrestrial or land sources, such as a swamp, or whether it was marine, oceanic. The things that we found in the 1002 area particularly, there are at least five shale sequences that have at least the potential for generating oil in the 1002 area. The Hugh Shale is primarily the source that the 1002 report identified as that one most likely to contribute to the oil in the area. In addition, you had the Shublik, the Kinyak, the Pebble Shale, and also some of the Canning River shales. It's postulated that those are probably gas-prone shales, but that determination has not yet been made, and for the purposes of this investigation, they could go either way. Not only do you have to have the shale and the source rock present, but you also have to cook that. In essence, it's the same thing as a stew. If it's raw, it's not really palatable. It needs to be cooked, and it can be done either by heating or with a lot of pressure, which causes the heat. That really changes the raw materials from the kerogens in the shale into something we would recognize, oil and gas. Okay, now, that's one of the main ingredients. You can't have an accumulation without source rock. Well, the very best source rock in the world isn't going to do us any good whatsoever unless there's some place to put it, which we call the reservoir rocks. So the next step in the evaluation process is to identify those reservoir rocks. Reservoir rocks is just as the name implies. They are primarily sands and limestones or dolomites. And if I'm getting too simplistic, just holler at me, but some of the times a picture like this helps to explain things a lot easier. If you're looking at a formation down in there, and between the sand grains are openings or porosity, that's primarily the reservoir that we're looking at. Once the shales have been cooked, ideally, and the material contained within the shale is pressed out, it's looking for a place to accumulate. It's looking for those voids. Even though a piece of sandstone or a piece of limestone may look very solid, very hard, under inspection with a microscope, you'll find that there's quite a bit of opening. The very best reservoir rocks in Prudhoe Bay, for instance, run up to 21-23% porosity or void space within a given volume of rock. That's really a rare exception. Most times you find it down in the 8-12% range, and that's still not a bad reservoir rock. So we'll back up to the next chart here again, or back up to the other chart. The reservoir rocks that we identified in the 1002 area are composed of about seven different plays. And they range down from the top sets, which is basically a Canning River, to the, these are a whole list of geologic names, the turbidites, Ellesmerian undisturbed, folded, really doesn't make that much difference what they are. Between the USGS and the BLM, we basically identified seven potential reservoir rocks within the 1002 area. It's important to remember at this point that we're dealing with 26,000 plus foot of sedimentary section. And even though we may have only identified seven potential reservoir zones, that by no means, with our level of understanding of the subsurface there, precludes there being more than that. We feel fairly safe in saying there are at least seven within this area. And they range from sandstones, limestones, and dolomites. The porosity, which you saw from the other chart, I think we believe is there in some significant proportion. Again, this is supposition, but looking at the Prudhoe Bay fields to the west and the Mackenzie Delta fields to the east, it's a fairly safe assumption. All right, we've got the source rock, the shale. We've cooked that and turned it into oil. We've migrated into areas that will hold it. The next thing is these reservoir rocks, they'll hold the oil, but just like water and oil mix, the oil is going to rise to the surface and will continue to rise toward the surface unless that track is impeded in some fashion or another. And that's the last important aspect of an oil accumulation, is a trap. There are many different kinds of traps in the geologic section. I'm sure you recognize this one?
Mm-hmm.
See if we can get it on there straight. This is a representation of the subsurface in the 1002 area as we've interpreted it from the geophysical lines. We're looking for traps. We're looking for structures. The simplest kind of trap is a structural trap, basically an inverted bowl, which you see identified there. Just a second, if I can borrow a pen here. Thank you, Reed. Here and up here, this is not real easy to see, but I'll show you a little bit more simplified graphic. Basically, the oil is coming up out of the deep area here, migrating along and accumulating in these bowls. Another kind of trap is a fault trap. Basically, the oil migrates upward until it hits a sharp wall, if you will, where it can move no further. And that's where it stops. That's the fault trap. Oil can also be moving upgrade in a sandstone, and the sand begins to slowly turn into a shale and comes to a dead halt. That becomes a stratigraphic trap. The entire 1002 area has many opportunities for these types of trapping mechanisms to occur. Obviously, the easiest ones to model are the structural traps. These are simply the large bowls that occur throughout the 1002 area. They're the easiest to identify because they show up the best on a seismic record. The fault traps are less dependable because a fault can either break a seal or it can cause a seal to happen. Drilling evidence is necessary to support that. And also the stratigraphic traps, they're very hard to spot on the seismic record. So they become very, very difficult. I'd like to draw your attention to the seismic grid that we base this interpretation on. That's not quite right, but I think you get the picture here. These are extremely large structures. They're the sort of things that leap out at you. The point was made this morning that Milne Point could fall through this grid, and that's certainly the case. Many other small fields could fall through this grid. But we're not dealing with small structures out there. They are verified and cross-verified and verified again.
You said small structures like it would show up. Yeah. That's called maybe verified.
Yeah,
he said it could fall through.
Okay, maybe this will help explain just a little bit what I mean by types of structural traps. The oil is coming up here. It's been generated in the shale down here, source rock. It's come up into a reservoir rock, and it's moving happily toward the surface. And all of a sudden, it hits the top here. Oil will not be driven. It has to be driven down by some kind of a force to get it out of there. So gravity and just its natural buoyancy is going to cause it to accumulate up in here. For the most part, and this is a simplified cartoon, what you're looking at in the 26 prospects that have been identified are these kinds of traps here. A fault trap, the same thing, is generated in the shales, hits the reservoir rock and starts moving upwards until it hits a sharp fault. This limestone, which is depicted here, could have come from up here and slid down, or from down here and slid up. In this depiction, it's basically slid up and it's caused an impermeable barrier for the oil to come through. It hits that fault and it stops. If you notice the sharp relief in the 1002 area, going from 26,000 feet up to the surface, there's many, many faults in that area which could be forming traps like this. Difficult to prove that they're there, so therefore they weren't modeled in the 1002 assessment.
What did Muckluck miss?
Muckluck was a very subtle trap, such as this. This one here, the depiction is that it's fairly steep, fairly well defined. Muckluck, if you will, was just like a dinner plate turned over on its side. It was very, very large in area extent, but the depth to which the crest, the bottom, was relatively small. So there's some consideration whether there really was a total closure there. And it turned out either there wasn't or there was never enough oil generated to fill it up. The point is, it was a very subtle but very large feature. In the 1002 area, we're dealing with very large features that are very, very obvious on the seismic record. The third type of trap I talked about was the stratigraphic trap. Again, the shale. The oil is generated, it hits the sandstone, and begins moving upwards. But during the geologic depositional history, the sandstone might have petered out. If you think of this as the edge of a channel bank or the end of a bar island, it basically went from sand into shale. The oil is moving up here, and shale is by nature very tight and forms a good seal in most cases. So the oil is trapped there. Again, the important thing to remember is that it's moving up gradient. And if you'll refer back your mind to that picture of the subsurface there in 3D, there's a lot of relief in that area. There's a very large, what we call a fetch area, a very large shale potential area out to the north and off to the west that could be generating these oils and moving up through this area.
Mike, is that the same basic structure that you have down on the south side of the range, down in the Venati country? They got an awful lot of surface shale. Is that the same stuff, only it's come to the surface?
It's not the same formation, Senator Coghill. The shale is certainly an important part of it. Down in the Venati area, what it appears to be is that shale was put under an awful lot of heat. Basically, we burnt your stew, turned it into basically carbon. The shale probably at one time did contain kerogen or oil-making material, but it's been overcooked and smucked up to the point that there really is nothing left anymore.
I see.
And that's what we talk about when we talk about an overmature basin or an overmature area. Mm. It's been overheated and basically the stew's been burnt.
Damn. Cooked.
And, you know, it sounds kind of funny, but it really is cooking in the truest sense of the word. You start with your raw materials and you heat it up and you heat it up, and if it's just right, like Goldilocks' porridge, you got some real sweet crude oil. If you overheat it or you don't underheat it enough, you really don't have anything that anybody's going to be interested in.
Where does coal come into that whole structure?
Coal is basically plant material, whereas the best kerogens that make go into the oil were probably animal at one time, or at least a greasy, oily substance. Coal is a leaf material, compressed leaf material, and it derives from the swamps, basically a land terrain, whereas your best kerogens are derived from marine sequences, basically where there's a lot of one-celled organisms.
One more simple question.
Okay.
Why are they kind of together a lot of times?
Well, to consider geology, you basically have to look backward in time, millions and millions of years. And in a geologist's mind, in Mother Nature certainly, you reconstruct the rising and the falling of the oceans. Mountain ranges rise, are eroded back, and fall back down again. The ocean comes in and backs off. So basically, you end up with a whole strata of different kinds of sequences, primarily shore, marine, mountains, swamps, deserts. They're all stacked up in time over each other. As Mother Nature erodes her way back down there, she begins to expose these different sequences. Even though they occurred at the same point on the globe, they're stacked up and represent a tremendous variety of geologic terrains throughout time there. We find coal with oil and gas. It simply meant at one time there was a marine sequence collecting the oil. The ocean dried up or went away, and a swamp came over the top of it and deposited coal, and then the ocean came back and put oil back on top of it again. So you have to think in the third dimension and project that back in time, millions and millions of years.
That's all this gets
you. In truth, geologists are basically wild-eyed dreamers. They make good detectives, too. And that's what you're looking at here. You end up with a 10,000-piece puzzle, and at any one given time, your geologist has only 10 or 12 pieces. And he does a pretty good job of reconstructing what the total picture looks like.
What about oil seeps? That would be, you know, we've talked about muckluck and what it didn't have. What about oil seeps? They're not necessarily indicative of what you find.
An oil seep tells us one thing. If you look back here at the source rock, what an oil seep tells us is that one time, at least in the geologic history, there was shale there, and it had the right kind of material within it, and it was cooked to the right temperature to make oil. That does not tell us how much is there or when in history that it happens, because this oil is seeping up from the subsurface, and when it gets to the surface, we really have no way of telling exactly where it started. But what it is one-third of the equation that's necessary for oil to accumulate. We know that within that geologic basin, at least, we had the right sequence of events to create oil. Now, whether there's something there to hold it or something there to trap it, we have to investigate further. But it is a very key element. Many basins in Alaska, particularly, and around the world, are dry. There's no oil in them whatsoever. So when you do see an oil seep, you don't go out and sell the car and invest in the drilling company, but at least you start thinking about it. Okay, we've continued along now. In the 1002 area, we looked at the source rock and decided, by golly, there's source rock there. We looked at the reservoir rock, and from everything around it, we decided there's a pretty good chance of reservoir rock. We studied the geophysical evidence and the mapping that we did on the surface, and we figured, by golly, there's a good chance of their trapping mechanisms being there. And that equals an oil accumulation. Now, if you'll note, there's no cumulative information attached to that oil accumulation. We simply decided it was there. The next step is to try to figure out how much is there. Again, working with the USGS, the BLM, calculated the amount of in-place resource. It's easy to think about in-place resource. If you have dumped a 55-gallon drum of oil over in this room and troweled it out evenly across the carpet, you would have 55 gallons of in-place oil. To try to figure out how much of that is actually recoverable, how much you can pick back up and sell to the corner gas station, that becomes the recoverable oil. And because of the nature of the carpet and the fact that it's spread out so much, you're not going to get back your 55 gallons. As a matter of fact, you can get back a very small portion of that. What the USGS and the BLM did in concert was come up with this curve, basically. Said there was about 13.8 billion barrels of oil in place in the 1002 area. Now, that's a mean number, and I put up this graph because I'd like to illustrate that. The thing to really keep in mind are the, at least to look at and consider, are the tails of those distributions that go all the way from the zero line here all the way over to the 50. And even though it's not depicted too well in this graph, and I'll have this one changed by the time we get to Kodiak, that tail there should not quite touch that bottom line. Okay, it extends out to some distance, some theoretical extreme, but it's a long ways out there. The chances of that number being present is frighteningly low, but nonetheless it does exist. The mean represents our best guesses, myself and about 30 other geologists from the USGS and the Bureau of Land Management scattered around the country. All of the information we looked at from that previous flow chart was considered, and this number cranked out of it. I hesitate to put this one up here, but I guess we can talk about it at this point.
Sure.
In addition to the oil, there's obviously, or at least there's a very good chance of there being gas present in the 1002 area. The gas question is a bit controversial, but let me deal with it at least one point right here. We did calculate the presence of gas as an in-place resource, and it came out in the mean at about 31.3 trillion cubic feet. The accumulation cares not whether it's oil or gas, it's simply a hydrocarbon accumulation, so therefore oil and gas are added, or at least stacked side by side. Back to our old friend here again. We basically completed the top row, the geologic considerations, throughout the 1002 area. At that point, the BLM sort of went off on its own and pursued its expertise in the economic considerations. And oil accumulation can be anywhere from a gallon up to an infinite amount, or not almost infinite amount of barrels in place. Tremendous amounts. The question remains, at what point does an accumulation have enough positive attributes to be developable? And that changes literally, without exaggerating, changes from hour to hour with the fluctuation in cost of development and the cost that you would hope to receive when you sold that commodity. We basically looked, again, as I've heard me say before, for the raisins in the raisin bread. The 26 prospects represented our accumulations. But those 26 still weren't quite good enough to measure up, at least in our opinion. So we wanted to take a look at the economic ramifications. How big did that accumulation have to be? To determine that, we considered a wide variety of items, development costs, a few of them you see represented there, tariffs, taxes, oil prices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, at the bottom line, in the projected cost of $33 per barrel about the year 2000, we would assume that you'd need about 440 million barrels of oil, million barrels of oil to be economically developable out in the 1002 area. With that in mind, we basically dropped back to five of the larger prospects, represented the size and had the character and attributes necessary to be developable. With those fives and the economic assessment in place, we reach our bottom line in the 1002 mineral assessment, and that's the 3.23 billion barrels of recoverable oil that you've seen represented throughout the 1002 report and in the media. That represents a commodity of oil that we believe not only exists, but can be developed, brought to the surface, and market economically. And there's economically should be underlined here. If you were to change the price of oil from 33 up to 60, it would have a tremendous impact on the barrels of recoverable oil. Likewise, if you dropped the price of oil down to $5 per barrel, it would also have a very distinct impact on the level of economically recoverable oil.
I'm sorry, what was your $440 million?
Right now, Senator Sergulski, it would appear, based on our projections of the economics as we interpret them, that it would take about a 440 million barrel accumulation in the 1002 area to be economically developed under the existing economic conditions.
Okay, that would have to be the first thing that could lead then to a pipeline and all the rest. Then what's your $3.23 billion?
That's basically those accumulations out there that we believe would be developed at that threshold level. The argument can be made that once the cost of the pipeline is in place, then a lot of the smaller fields then become economically recoverable. We could have modeled that, but it kind of led us into a swamp. We began building an assessment based on a lot of economic assumptions that may or may not come to fruition. So we felt it best to avoid the over-dramatization of that area, to stick with what we could actually prove and what we thought was theoretically possible given conditions as they exist today. So we modeled the five prospects being economically recoverable. I draw your attention again to this graph is right, out here to the end. There's a lot of potential oil out there, theoretical. One of the things that really struck us early on in the interpretation about this area, and I think it raised everybody's level of expectation, is when we started looking at these kind of comparisons. And that's what raises the 1002 area well above the norm. We wouldn't be seeing this kind of excitement on a small field in South Texas, something else even in the interior of Alaska. The 1002 area represents, to my understanding and my knowledge, a fairly unique set of circumstances, at least on the North American continent. When you begin to have prospects of the size that we've identified out there, in the area, geographically, between two large oil-producing areas, with the subsurface constituents we believe are there, you begin to have some extremely large potential accumulations. And those are the eight largest prospects out there. You can see how they match up against Kuparuk, which right now is the second largest oil field in North America. Prudhoe Bay, East Texas, that's what East Texas was. That's not what East Texas is. Elk Hills, Point Aguero. It's a significant accumulation potential. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. How does this chart match up against the 3.2 billion barrels? I've seen this before, and I can't tie those two together, do they?
The 3.2 billion barrels basically represents the potential represented by those five largest prospects.
You have to look at the
means, and then you have to model those two. It's very dangerous to begin adding straight across in any of these graphs. The 1002 report spent a lot of time trying to show what you could add and what you couldn't add.
Basically, the five large prospects, the mean or the 95%, which one?
Get the mean.
The mean?
And they still don't add straight across and add them up. You have to put them through the Presto model.
Oh, okay.
And what comes out of there becomes an economic risk mean. And if you'd really like to understand, we can sit down with a pad of paper. It'll take me about an hour to straighten it all out, though. And it would probably put most people to sleep. You can take our word for it, or B, we can get together with a big pad of paper and walk you through it. Basically, this has been scrutinized by lots and lots of people, and it's a reasonable treatment of mathematics. It doesn't violate any laws that I know of, anyway.
I guess a simple thing, and maybe this is too damn or darn simple, so it's got to be all wet, but you've got a couple of fields there that are Prudhoe signs, and Prudhoe's going to have theoretically recoverable of, you know, the figure we see is 9.6 billion, and you're talking about a recovery of 3.2 billion. So what am I missing?
What you're missing, the number 3.2 billion represents a lot of our anxiety and hand-wringing and risk analysis. I cannot stand before you today and say that those five prospects exist as modeled.
Okay, but as modeled, it does not reflect the 3.2.
No.
It reflects substantially higher.
Right.
Either that or I'm...
No, you're right.
Okay.
The theoretical potential of those prospects is as you see them there. In other words, they're big enough and there's enough oil out in that area we theorized to fill them up to that point, to make them very large. but I can't stand before you today and swear on a Bible that that's the way it's going to be.
I'll tell you, if you could, you'd be Midas.
Yeah, I would. I'd also be a rich man. I'm sure my friends from Chevron and Sohio would probably snap me right up if I could make those kind of predictions come true. Good. The point to really remember here is that the potential is really significant out there.
Are those eight large prospects in Anwar, could you kind of give us an idea where the witching stick was at in each one of those? Is that largest one, is that in section 18?
Well,
or is that an unfair question?
It's a touchy question. Let's simply say that
tilt.
Anybody that... No, I can go a little bit. I'll dance out on the limb a little here for you. You can simply take a look at the 26 prospects and take a look at the size of those prospects. And then you can take a look at the size of these graphs. And based on what I told you, you can start to match bars with prospects. I mean, you could do that. I'm not telling you to do that, but you could do that.
If you do that, that's 18.
That's right. Well, and we've danced that. Is the marsh crack, well, I guess that's not a very fair question.
I guess it's 18.
Okay, I just thought I'd wrap this up just a touch for you. Basically, the assessment then was a byproduct of the two agencies, 30-some people involved, and we stepped through all of these particular boxes, ovoids, drops. The dollar profit or loss at the end should have a large question mark over. Time will tell whether it is a profit or whether it is a loss. That's why you have a choice there. The point is, we considered, I believe, everything that prudently should be considered, and we've come up with a fairly conservative resource assessment of the area. That kind of finishes my prepared text, and I guess we can start responding to your questions.
Senator Jones.
Okay, some of these structures you talked about, prospects, they lie in this, some of them lie over in the Canyon River area.
That's correct, Senator Jones.
All right, this land over here, now this is state land also? Or this is state land?
Yes.
Just outside the... All right, is the state... Are there some exploratory wells, some exploration going on right in this area here? Just across the border?
There has been quite a few holes drilled over there, that's correct.
All right. Does the geology remain similar in this area?
I'll get up and show you my hand. The geology makes a real dramatic turn, unfortunately, once we get into the 1002 area. Basically, the Marsh Creek complex, as we call it, runs about like so, and that marks a demarcation from the relatively simplistic flatline geology over here into a much more complicated regime in here. Therefore, what conclusions we can draw from this well, we can use them in this area. It's not a one-to-one relationship. Basically, have to cross over that feature and we get into another type of geologic terrain. The rocks are basically the same, but the structural history, the torsion, the twisting, and the movement that it's gone through during the course of time is significant.
So there's no exploration over here that you can relate to in this area?
Not on a one-to-one. Certainly the information gained from these wells along here contributed a significant part of our assessment.
Thank you, John.
Dangerous to say that everything in those wells would be applied directly to what lies inside the Marsh Creek.
The state does have that information for this?
Yes.
Outside?
Yes, and quite a bit of that information is available in the public record. It was used in the 1002 report.
In the 1002 report, I think that you described about eight structures, didn't you, that kind of went on an angle, but...
There were a good many in there, Senator.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
correct. Yeah. Matter of fact, the bulk and numbers are in that area there.
Okay. Now that we've gone that far, Reed, where do we go from here? Do you want to follow up on your evaluation and how you block that, or where we go from here?
Well, we're ready to try to answer any questions you might have. Anything you'd like us to provide for you?
Well, I think that it's so technical that it's, you know, that you're almost, that the structure, as I understand it, the structure that you're tracking is, you probably know more about what's on the offshore than you know what's inshore. Is that a good statement?
It's an interesting statement. I believe we know quite a bit of what's onshore. I have not studied any great detail of the offshore section. As I was telling Senator Jones, that same terrain that's represented over in the Canning River and a little bit west of there is, for lack of better terms, relatively simple compared to what you have in the 1002 area. That simplified region, if you will, arcs around behind the 1002 area to the north of the 1002 area. As you get away from the Brooks Range, the further you go, the more simple the geology becomes. So therefore, conclusions drawn from the offshore, again, are not a one-to-one relationship with what you see in the 1002 area.
Okay. Management units, has there been any, has the Interior Department made any approaches, or has there been any discussion on management alternatives for the 1002 once it's open for gas and oil? Are we going to get biologists managing drilling rigs, or are we going to have geologists managing? You know what I'm saying? Has there been any discussion? I think there's a departure. I think the Fish and Wildlife's doing a good job in there, but their texture, they're basically habitat people. And has there been any approach in this area?
I haven't been in on a lot of the negotiations and talks about this, but basically the Fish and Wildlife Service might be able to answer that better. I would envision myself that the Bureau of Land Management would be involved in the operational aspects of the oil and gas development, just like we are on other federal lands.
Certainly, if history is any teacher of the future, BLM will have a very active role in watching out over the operations on the shore. And they'll be working hand-in-hand with the Fish and Wildlife Surface Protection Specialist to make sure that everything takes place with as least of an impact as possible.
So what you're saying, there'd be a team effort of probably all three of your organizations, the BLM, USGS, and Fish and Wildlife.
Well, USGS is basically will bow out, already has bowed out at this point.
Oh, is that
They're
right?
Concerned more with the science, the research, and the in-place resource. The actual hands-on, if you will, junkyard dog oversight belongs to the BLM, and that does take place throughout the United States. We have experts trained in operations, and they are smart enough to work with their surface protection specialists from the other agencies.
How about the, if we're on the coastal plain, do we get the Corps of Engineers in the middle of this thing with all of the wetlands and that type of thing? Or I guess the reason why I'm asking that is what happens as far as all of the impact statements, and when we proceed from here, how does that go? Do they become a part of the whole structure?
I would defer that to either Fish and Wildlife or Reed here. They certainly get involved. At what point they become involved has never been exactly clear from a geologist's point of view.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sure they would be involved. I don't know exactly to what extent, but they would be
John,
involved.
Do you know?
The Corps of Engineer involvement in any operations that would take place up there.
Mr. Chairman, it's our expectation that the Corps of Engineers and other federal regulatory agencies, along with state regulatory agencies, would perform in a normal fashion, whether it would be, unless there is some sort of an exemption built into the legislative process of some sort, but we're dealing with the prospect at this point that the normal 404 permitting process will be followed up there, and of course, as most of you are probably aware, most of that area falls into a wetlands category.
Wet.
There's land there somewhere.
Navigable?
Yeah.
Navigable streams? at certain times of the year? No. Well, is there any other questions? If not, why, thank you, Reed and Mike, and we'll just kind of hang back there, and we'll see if there's anything else that comes around. And we'd like to get Gil Mall up with the state people, and
thank you.
And
I understand this gentleman's spent a little time up in that Northland.
He has. Probably.
And he almost got phased out of business.
Gil, welcome to our table, and I guess you're the state geologist, and I guess what we want to do is to get on record what you know about ANWR. How much information does the state have on ANWR? And we'll start with those two.
Probably better start.
Yeah.
Better start off with a couple of corrections. I'm not the state geologist.
Oh.
I'm one of a number. In fact, I am phased out right at the moment on this year's budget. I'll be back in on next year's budget for 4 months, and we're sort of on a yo-yo still, but things have improved considerably since the State Geological Survey was resurrected 2 weeks ago, and we have a director, and we're no longer in the Division of Mining, and so we have some future, we think. Let me grab my coat, if I could, here again, to lubricate the...
Sure. We're not that rigid now, Gil. Just take your time.
I didn't have a lot of advance notice. I don't have a lot of visual aids. Their presentation, you know. I was asked if I could talk about some of the aspects of geology. I suppose to start off, maybe what I should do is just give a brief summary of my background. And I could say, basically, my background is as a surface geologist. I've worked in ANWR since 1963. At various times, I think 13 partial field seasons or entire field seasons. And of course, up there, our field season is at most about 2 months long. So at various times, it's been up 2 months, shorter periods, sometimes just a week or so at a time. I started off with Richfield Oil. Couple or three field seasons there. Worked with Exxon two or three field seasons in ANWR. Worked on the Proto Bay prospect. Was a well site geologist on the Proto Bay discovery wells. So I have some background over there. Friends of mine say, well, I keep switching jobs to keep working in Northern Alaska, and I did that. Went to the USGS in 1975 and spent 6 years with the USGS. Again, working in ANWR on the National Petroleum Reserve, and worked also in the process of developing some of the appraisal methodology that was used in developing these numerical appraisals. 1981, after the D2 hassles, I joined the state then. I've been with the State Geological Survey until present, where we're yo-yoing back and forth. I don't have a lot of subsurface experience. I have no access to the subsurface, the seismic data that were developed on ANWR, other than what I've seen published in the 1002 report. The state, our now Division of Oil and Gas, of course, has access to that seismic data. That, of course, is all proprietary data, and I have not been involved in that. So what I can tell you is basically what I know of the surface geologic relationships and sort of the regional extrapolations that we can make into the subsurface based on what we know of the surface strata and the access to the seismic that I see published. Nor do I have access to the proprietary well data that are immediately west of the range. Actually, there are some open well data, but there are proprietary data also that I do not have access to. So with that sort of background, it might help in letting you know some of the things I might be able to answer and some things that I simply don't know about. Mm-hmm. So I'm at your disposal as to what sort of questions you'd like to like the fire.
How many years is they have you say you were with them in the Anwar area before you were over in Prudhoe, right? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, we actually, our first field season in 1963, we actually started out at a place called Uniad, which is south of Prudhoe, but then immediately after that ended up working in Anwar. Of course, there are no surface outcrops in the immediate Prudhoe Bay area.
Yeah.
So we were working in the outcrop area of Anwar at that time.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgalewski.
Yes, I'd be interested if you could just briefly tell us what relationship there is to the surficial geology and subsurface, and how you have you had an opportunity to relate in has the work that you've done gone into the work that the state has done in determining whether or not there what potential there is in the area?
Yeah, I think you could say that what we've identified in the outcrop, we plug into the seismic data. We did that with industry, and we've done the same thing here. You see a sequence of strata in outcrop. You project that into the subsurface and try to identify what the reflectors may be that you see on the seismic data. It actually worked out quite successfully when we drilled the discovery well at Prudhoe Bay. Most of the reflectors that we had identified on the seismic turned out to be what we thought they would be.
What is a reflector? What does that mean?
I wish I had a visual aid, but on the seismic, actually I do have, unfortunately, the little things I could pass out. These are... These are just simply Xerox copies out of some of the seismic lines that were in the 1002 report. And if you look at that, you'll see sort of subtle darker horizons that run across through, and not the black lines on it, but the more subtle gray to black or white lines. Those indicate, those are reflections of seismic waves from the surface, bouncing off a strata and bouncing back to the surface.
Yeah.
So that is a representation of what the configuration of the strata in the subsurface may be. And those reflectors, those strata may be of considerable interest. And if you notice on this one that I passed out, some of them are colored yellow or colored blue, I think, on all of them you received. That is a perceived reflector identification of what we would call the Alsmerian sequence. It's a projection, and when I say we again, of course, this is work that the USGS and BLM did, but they identified as a possibility that horizon colored blue could be this Alsmerian sequence. That's a particularly significant sequence because that's the main productive horizon to the Alsmerian sequence. The Saddle Roche groups specifically, it's the main productive horizon at Prudhoe Bay. I just colored it in on this particular seismic line because it's an area that is structurally rather high, closer to the surface, and might be an area of considerable interest. So at any rate, in doing this work, we identify the sequence of strata in the outcrop, try to identify then on the seismic what those may be, and you make predictions or projections into the subsurface when drilling a well is to, you'll identify an objective that you might like to drill for because you think it has porosity, has reservoir potential, as Mike was pointing out. So it becomes very critical, and you'd like to know what those rocks are down there before you drill the well.
Mr. Chairman, just again, learning.
Yep.
Does the geological service part of it handle surficial as well as subsurface? You talked about oil and gas. It's still the science is geology, is it not, that does both?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Now sort of under a general term, geoscientists is a more general term that's being used nowadays. They're related disciplines. The surface geologists, of course, deal with a little different style of work than people who deal strictly with the subsurface. And we try with varying degrees of success to mesh those two disciplines together. And it really does require a degree of meshing of those to get the best appraisal possible.
Is most Representative Sun?
Yeah, I just had a question. In your opening presentation, you were speaking about access to data. Mm-hmm. And you made a statement, the state oil and gas department has access to the data. Is that the seismic data or the well data?
Well, both. The state that is has access to well data that are drilled on all wells drilled on state lands. A lot of those are proprietary data.
The Conservation Commission has that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Division of Oil and Gas and the Oil and Gas Section of the State Geological Survey has access on a proprietary basis to those data. But some of those, say, are not publicly available, and I can't get into that. I'm not totally conversant with all of the legislative requirements, but some of those are not publicly available. Other wells have been released by industry and are available to anyone to play with.
We have a bill we're working on.
Take care of all of that.
Well, I was just trying to differentiate between what the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has and what our Division of Petroleum has, and I just wonder if there was a difference there.
Actually, there is a difference there also, because the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, I think, do have some wells that, in fact, even the people in the Oil and Gas, the Division of Oil and Gas, do not have access to. I don't think there are too many of those cases. But
the Kick well
Kick
is one, I think.
Kick certainly would be one, yes.
Yeah.
And I believe there are other wells that are under that same category. Again, this gets somewhat out of my realm because I don't work with those subsurface data regularly.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted on the record that I think Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has the Kick well data, but the Department of Natural Resources does not.
But it's locked up so tight you can't find the key.
That's probably
true. That would be true, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The other aspect, of course, the data would be the seismic.
Gil, I'd like to kind of go through a series here. You say that you went up there first at Umiat in 63 and then you went to work for the state for a while?
Well, actually, I started off at Richfield Oil, which is now Atlantic Richfield.
But you were over there and then you went over into the...
Yeah, we had a wide-ranging field program that ranged from Umiat to Anwar that first field season, so we worked all the outcrop area from sort of Umiat along the mountain front into Anwar. I spent about 6 years with Exxon and doing some of the same thing across the entire Brooks Range, including Anwar, and then to the USGS.
So basically your experience is so widespread that when you came on board with the state, why there was a lot of stuff that you maybe couldn't share, but you knew you had some good nomers where you knew where to go, where the good stuff was, like having a berry patch, you know.
There's a collective knowledge that accumulates that you don't have access to it other than in your head.
Yeah.
But,
so most of your experience that you did up there was not from the geoscience of the all of the seismic and the shooting and all of this, but it was mostly from outcropping and surface type geology. Is that correct?
The bulk of it, except that I did get involved with the geophysicists when we were trying to identify reflectors, and this was with Richfield Oil into the subsurface in the Great Bay Area, and ended up as well site geologist when they were drilling some of the wells there. But the vast majority of it has been surface experience.
Yeah. So were you with them when they did all of that gridding across the Anwar?
No, that
the grids that Mike showed us.
No, that by that time I was with the state, so I have not had access to that. I think it was 1983 after I started with the state, I suggested to then Director Ross Schaff that for the benefit of sort of watching after the state's interest that we, the state, should have access to those data when that data was going to be acquired, that we should get access to it so that we would be able to make an independent appraisal, separate and discrete from that the BLM and USGS would do.
But you have that now, haven't you?
So we wrote a memorandum to Commissioner Wanneke at that time, and eventually got wheels in motion that eventually resulted in the state having access to those seismic data that the industry consortium shot. Access just as the USGS and BLM have on a proprietary basis. So our group dealt with those data and did the independent interpretation.
So then we could fairly well say that the state has enough identified identifiers with all of that grid and with the experience that you bring to the table with being able to do the surface geology that where the state should look first in ANWR for oil or where the good identifiers would be to drill. In other words, there is enough in-house expertise for us to be able to make a conscious decision.
Well, of course, for a geologist, there are never enough data to do it as well.
Well, I understand, Gil, that they told us in Anchorage that if you had 21 geologists in the room, you'd get 22 opinions. So.
Yeah, that's probably close to factual.
Were they talking about the legislature?
Well, they used the word, they used the term Senator 20, so that you could draw your own conclusion.
We certainly have a lot of data, and in fact we've accumulated quite a bit of data in the past field season. In fact, since the state appraisal was done, the State Geological Survey, working with a number of people from the University of Alaska last year and the summer before last, in fact, have acquired more data, outcrop data. And I frankly couldn't say at this point that we have as good an appraisal as we can do, even on the existing data. But we can certainly make a projection. It certainly can be improved.
Senator Jones, did you have a question?
No, you asked him.
That's one of the main things is that we wanted to get you down to see if we could get on the record whether there was a fair assessment as to the position that maybe the state was in an unfair position, but with all of the effort that we've put into geology up there and doing all of these things, that with your expertise up there, it seems that there is, that we're on not on a on a preference position, but we're on the same level as those people that might have the kick well, because as I understand it, the kick well in unit 18 is in a different structure.
Yeah, I really wouldn't want to say that we're on a par. The state organization started behind most of industry. We've acquired a certain amount of data, of course the collective USGS data over the years were available to us before active field work by the state in ANWR really didn't begin until actually 1975. The other data we have are bits and pieces that based on my work in prior times, other people who worked with us who had some previous experience there. But in terms of a really coordinated, coherent attempt at acquiring data, that really didn't begin actively until really 1985. Most industry groups have had an active program going there for considerably longer than that. We're certainly getting up there. We certainly can't, with what we know, we can't compete, certainly not knowing anything about the kick well. We're getting there, and it's certainly we're getting maybe close to competitive in some ways. But our expertise also in seismic interpretation is probably not what many industry groups would have either.
Well, I imagine that what you're saying is that the ones that the partners that drilled the kick well would of course have the by far the best information, but.
an interesting observation. We've noticed that the departments that drill the Kickwell are, in fact, both going to have surface geological field parties running again this summer, which suggests to us that they must have found something there that they've got. They're scratching their heads and they're going back to the outcrop, which is sort of interesting. We keep thinking, well, when you have all that subsurface information, they must be way ahead, but there apparently are still things to be learned from the outcrop, and we're still planning to go out and to do more outcrop work this summer.
Well, I see on one of the maps in the 1002 report that they talk about the Marsh Creek anticline, but I thought that they had two or three other structures that they talked about. And it seems to me that I recall when we had our first discussion on it that there was two or three other layers that laid out that way, and that Marsh Creek was only one of them, and that 18, which is the one over on that far side where the Kickwell is, was in one structure. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, apparently from the from what I see of the published seismic, that apparently is a correct statement. And it's sort of interesting. That area sort of coincides with an area that I became interested in some 10 years ago, because it happens to coincide with a high, what's called a gravity high, the force of gravity as measured across the entire reserve. Indicates that there's a structurally high area in that, sort of in the general area of that area 18, and the area of greatest interest in the Kickwell sort of coincides with that. So I've long thought myself, and that's just my own personal opinion, and would not necessarily coincide with people from the Division of Oil and Gas, but my own personal opinion is that that has always been more interesting to me, that area sort of south and east of Barter Island, than in fact the obvious Marsh Creek anticline structure, which there's always sort of a tendency to focus on these big obvious anticlinal structures, of which Marsh Creek certainly is a very prominent and large feature.
Mr. Chairman?
Gil, if I get into sensitive areas, why just say tilt, because we don't want you to get into a position of giving away trade secrets when you got industry sitting out here and all the rest of it. But do you think the state has enough information that they could go to the map and point bank identify areas that would be of high likelihood and high interest to find oil? I mean, as a geologist and a probably pretty good poker player.
No, no. Well, as I said before, you never have as much information as you would like.
But can we identify? Let me
point my finger at a map and say this is where I would want to select a tract or drill a well, that this is where it's going to be. For one thing, as other people pointed out, the seismic grid that's been drilled is a fairly broad grid that through which a fair number of structures could fall. So I really would not want to say that we have sufficient information to make, we could certainly make a decision. We could make a decision on areas to select or areas of greater interest. We could make a more informed decision you can always make a more informed and better decision with more study and more work.
Well, you could.
But you could do that forever, of course.
I think Mr. Marshall told us in Anchorage yesterday that geologists suffer from paralysis of analysis.
That's true. We're never happy. There's always another.
I guess my point is that if this is the area that you're looking at, do we have enough information that you could say to the state, we should concentrate here, and we should concentrate here, and we should concentrate here?
My own subjective opinion on that is no, but if you look at in the 1002 report, it's a map on page 66. It's a map of blocks A, B, C, D.
66. Mm-hmm. 66. Page 68.
I'm sorry, it is 68. You know, in a very subjective sense, I would say taking big blocks of that type, you can make broad recommendations and say, well, that block C is better than block B, and you know, according to the analysis of the 1002 report, the block A and C are about comparable. I'm not sure that I would rate them exactly the same, but you could make a judgment on large blocks of that type. I probably think with the data available would not want to make judgments on blocks that would be much smaller than that.
Gary?
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, could I ask a question?
Sure.
Would you feel confident in making that kind of recommendation on blocks 2,560 acres in size?
No, I definitely would not.
That's all I wanted to add.
And how big is that compared to the whole?
Well, that's the same size, the track size, that the Interior is using as the basis for the land exchanges.
And on this map, what is that? Is that one of these?
It would be, it's the size of four sections. And I think the squares you have there are each sections.
I'm not sure if there's the sections or townships on that map.
Those are four.
Those are four section tracks.
Senator Sturgalewski was asking, and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered, Gil, if you knew where the offshore state lease was. I don't think we've had that. That's one that's proposed fairly soon. What's the location of that? Does anyone know?
It's basically. Well, I think what you're talking about, Camden Bay along the shoreline, it's a 3 mile.
Yeah, okay, where the river comes out. Is it actually